1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Now, Ginsberg's interpretation of Moloch has been repurposed by the philosopher Scott Alexander in his seminal essay, Meditations on Moloch. It describes the phenomenon now taking place in which global civilization seems trapped in a feverish race to annihilation. Nobody wants it, but nobody can stop it. Certain people, including a subset of artificial intelligence researchers of all people, are calling Moloch the prevailing god of our era. And like any god, Moloch is both hidden and in plain sight. Once you train your eyes to see him, you see him everywhere. The god Moloch is the god that knows there is a part of the human lizard brain that cannot resist competition. The god Moloch exploits this human weakness by fixing systems of competition in place so seemingly rigidly that the players will do anything to win, no matter if the game itself kills them. Everybody hates the game, but nobody can stop playing. Moloch waves his left hand and the Ukrainians will fight Russia to the death for their sovereignty, even risking nuclear winter. And Moloch waves his right hand and Russia will not stop fighting until it achieves what it perceives to be territorial integrity. Strategic escalation ensues and Moloch feasts on mutually assured destruction. Moloch is competition gone toxic. Another example of Moloch can be seen when environmental regulations are not enforced. Imagine a river protected by environmental laws. As long as the companies operating alongside that river comply with the laws, there's no problem. But if one company begins dumping into the river, then that company is able to externalize the cost of protecting the river and gains a competitive edge over the non-polluting companies. So the polluters' profits grow in comparison to the other companies to the point where it can eventually push the other companies out of business. So in order to compete, the other companies start polluting as well. Soon, there's a race to the bottom, and all the companies are polluting, and no one has a competitive edge anymore. Eventually, everyone gets cancer and dies due to drinking the toxic water from the river that they all polluted. Everybody loses. Long-term well-being was sacrificed for short-term competition. This is Moloch. Whenever we have an incentive structure that promotes individual behavior over collective behavior, we see these kinds of destructive situations often arise. It's not something that's in our system. It's how our system works. Now more than ever, we need cooperation. We need mutual understanding. I'm hoping that Moloch might build a language around its archetype and so people can start to understand each other, talk to each other about these existentially dire issues, and come together to talk about very important topics that are now the fulcrum of polarization through our media. Moloch thrives in the internet as well, most visibly on the social media platforms. In the social media world, reader response is measured in clicks. The more clicks, the more money is made. Studies conclusively show that rage is the emotional response that garners the most clicks. And for this reason, Facebook is rife with posts that elicit rage because this is how everyone individually competes with everyone else for viewer attention. The price that everyone pays is a polarized society, a nation on the brink of civil war, and a world on the brink of World War III. Nobody wants the end of the world, but these days, how else can you get your message across? All we can do is get more clicks than the other guy, and even if it means the collapse of civilization and the planet. The most classic Moloch scenario is the arms race. Every time a war planner lobbies Congress on why tens of billions more dollars are needed to develop these weapons of mass destruction, the only justification they can ever drum up is to say, well, it's because we've got to keep up with China and Russia. That's Moloch in a nutshell. But we don't want to put all of our money into weapons of mass destruction, and neither does China, and neither does Russia, and neither does North Korea. People want to we in America need to resurrect our collapsed systems of education, of healthcare, of infrastructure. But we're told by NPR and Fox News and CNN and the Democrats and the Republicans and the think tanks that we can't ever trust Russia or China. We can't ever trust Putin or Xi. We have no choice. We have to pour tens of billions of dollars each year into developing these weapons of mass destruction, into developing more nuclear bombs, and into developing more artificial intelligence, or AI. So the small-minded Congress members once again fire hose money into endless war. Apparently it's worth it to them, even if it does move the doomsday clock that much further to the end of the world. The inability to collectively think outside Moloch's rigid box of competition keeps society barreling toward Armageddon. And speaking of weapons, the darling this season in war spending is the hypersonic missile. What's most settling about hypersonics and actually all unmanned warfare is that they're being designed so that artificial intelligence, or AI, will eventually do most of the thinking to pull the trigger. Because the time between launch and strike of an incoming missile could be as brief as 6 minutes, it's believed that humans would be prone to panic within such a duration of time, whereas machines would not. The rational, emotionless thought processing required during such a moment of urgency is thought to be best handled by machines. Keep in mind, all these hypersonic missiles are nuclear capable. So as machine decision-making accelerates warfare, it's plain to see how conflict could easily escalate. Compressed time and space creates the incentive for each side to strike first and strike fast in a perceived crisis. This is a recipe for crisis instability. Even if neither party initially planned to strike first, the accelerated dynamic inherent in an AI-driven scenario forces the likelihood of mutually assured destruction, especially because AI is programmed only in the context of Moloch, of competition. Diplomacy is not part of the algorithm. It is not programmed in. In the past, development and production of nukes was predicated on the idea that mutually assured destruction would keep us safe as a deterrent. It would stop rational leaders of superpowers from escalating a war that would end in the destruction of both countries. No one ever factored into the equation what we have now, that one day algorithms would be making the decisions. Algorithms couldn't give a damn about mutual assured destruction or whether the planet is blown up to smithereens. This isn't an arms race, it's a suicide race. Even so, the U.S. is spending $1 trillion to expand nuclear weapon capacity and simultaneously pouring as much money, if not more, into transitioning its military into one that is for the most part unmanned and AI-driven. These AI weapons are being fast-tracked into existence. And once the highly advanced AI is developed for the military, we'll see it spun off into the consumer market in functions that will put millions of workers out of a job. Digital technology has always been an inequity accelerator. The more digital technology is developed, the wider the gap between rich and poor, the greater the poverty. We've all seen this in the last 20 years. The values of Moloch are inherent in digital technology because they are the same as the values of the Pentagon from which digital technology emerged. So, how do we break out of Moloch's grip? That is the $64 billion question. Law professor Mary Wood points out, and I thought this was interesting, the way she framed it, that how the world around us is framed is, in a narrative, can either oppress and subdue or empower and mobilize. Do you think the Moloch framing is useful in communicating to others or to yourselves how systems of competition work and affect us, and that maybe they're no longer useful? My hope is that by examining our predicament from this God's eye view of Moloch, a space might open up in which our ego can hopefully fall away and all parties involved are able to see new ways of problem solving through cooperation. We've got to put the brakes on this runaway train. I would love to hear your thoughts, and I'd like to open it up for discussion. Thank you so much.
Well, you've given me a lot to think about, and the point of needing to reframe is the bottom line. But we need to help others reframe. Back many years ago, back in the early 1980s, I volunteered with a group out of Kenya called Beyond War. And they were reframing. They were trying to reframe. And a lot of the concepts that I heard in the 1980s, we are one, you know, everything that you would already know, was picked up in general discussion. But it wasn't enough to move us off of the Moloch. So I'm wondering what more reframing has to occur in order to get us to move off of Moloch.
Well, in a way, we moved off a lot in the 80s because that's when the Berlin Wall came down. That's when Reagan and Gorbachev signed agreements. That's the precursor to Clinton closing bases. So maybe it did work. And then Moloch emerged, you know, like a bad case of herpes. Yes, in the back.
I'm wondering if there isn't a flip side to it, too. I mean, the things that you're saying are about how we get invisibilized, I think is the term that you used in... what I'm seeing is that, you know, here we are in the belly of the beast. Mm-hmm. We're in the belly of Moloch. Capitalism and competition personified to the utmost. And we can see that the young people that are around us, I have two teens at home, you know, people who like have succeeded according to the American dream, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, there's a discontent. There's an unfulfilled feeling. There's a jadedness that pervades our entire culture. And it takes like one person or two people standing up with courage, and you see people crawling out of the woodwork to join in with that effort. There's such a discontent that's permeating that as soon as people hear the seed of the word that you're saying or something else, that, you know, I think it gets undermined very easily. So, you know, I don't want to be overly optimistic, but I do want to point out that I think that a lot of that is going on, and I think we can all feel that. Especially here in the belly of, I know I'm saying it wrong.
Moloch.
Moloch, yes. Yeah. I've got the consonants all mixed up.
No, I agree with you. The capacity for cooperation is such a natural, instinctive thing for us. All you need to do, one person does it and everybody gloms on. I completely agree. And well, we just need more people doing it, and I don't think that's going to be too hard to achieve. But I think the thing that people need to be made aware is the revolution will not be on social media. It will not be on the internet. It will be holding hands with our brothers and sisters and talking and discussing and singing and dancing.
When Dennis Kucinich was in Congress, there was an effort to establish a U.S. Department of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just seeking peace on the international level, but in our states and cities and schools, neighborhoods, homes, working on peace everywhere. And here in New Mexico, there was an effort to establish a State Department modeled after that national proposal. I think we need to get back to that and work hard at trying to achieve that.
Mm-hmm. That definitely reframes it, doesn't it?
Yes. The other thing I'd like to share, I served in a Titan ICBM missile complex during the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis.
You're not that old.
I'm 80. I think I was 22 at that time. But we waited for the order. We expected to launch those horrible missiles. Back then, I wouldn't have hesitated to follow orders. I would have done my job and helped launch those horrible missiles. Now, I cringe to think that the decision may be made by artificial intelligence, because that's a situation where if AI was in charge,
right,
making the decisions,
we wouldn't be here today.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. But fortunately, President Kennedy and President Khrushchev talked it out. They didn't take the advice of their advisors. They were getting advice to do it, to go ahead and launch. If it was AI, more than likely that decision would have been made to launch.
Yeah.
To get to cooperation, Netta Crawford, who's at the Cost of War Project at Brown, she wrote a great book called, what is it, Pentagon, Climate Change, and War. And one of the things she talks about toward the conclusion is that the Pentagon assumes that we're going to have climate-caused wars. They feel like climate change is going to cause unstable governance in climate-vulnerable countries, global south mainly. And they're considering that it's inevitable, that mass migrations of people and competition over the most basic resources will bring war. And so they've been preparing for this for years. But Netta Crawford points out that in times of scarcity, in times of crisis, historically people often cooperate. Mm. You know, often cooperate. And we're caught in this web. And I appreciate all of your comments on technology. I'm so tired of clicktivism. I am so sick of it. It's not where the revolution is at, for sure. And I'm really inspired a lot by indigenous communities who don't have this mindset of competition kind of embedded into them from day one, you know. And indigenous communities and some of the youth groups now around climate really inspire me too. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. That reminds me, your story reminds me of in the early 90s, I was living on Kauai, and we had a terrible, terrible hurricane called Hurricane Iniki slammed us. We happened to be living in the Hawaii equivalent of a reservation called Hawaiian Homelands. It was amazing. After the hurricane, there was no electricity, no power. The gas stations wouldn't pump gas. It was just everything was dead, flattened. Immediately, the men and some women went out fishing, brought back a mess of fish. Everybody basically lived at the churchyard grounds for a week, just partying, playing ukulele, eating poi fish. And then once we got our car going, my mom and I went driving around the island to see how the other communities were faring. Not so good, because that was Molochville. So there's this, at the north side of the island, the wealthiest community at that time was called Princeville. And it was just like, there was a mountain of bologna sandwiches on white bread that the Red Cross had just brought in like days later, and a line of people just pissed off and fighting with each other. That really was like showed the difference between how the indigenous community could roll. They knew their land, they knew their resources, and the people that relied on a money economy, on the imports coming in, just only knew how to bicker with one another in that situation. That's exactly what you said. All right, one more. Has the other shoe dropped yet?
Well, actually, in a way it has, listening to all these comments. I'm left with the very strong feeling that it's the individual that's going to reframe, not society. Society will reframe after each of us as individuals have moved out beyond ourselves and shared it. And what you are doing is so enlightening.
What you're saying reminds me of something Greta Thunberg says, and she says, it's the individual and it's the leaders. It really is all of us. It's all this. We all have to be working all together all the time, no matter who we are. Not one or the other. But yeah, we can't leave ourselves out of it. And whatever you can do to ask yourself, what can I do? Just do what I do. I just talk to anybody that comes along.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, they're ramping up plutonium pit production at LANL, Los Alamos National Labs. Each one of these pits, that's just the core of the weapon. That's not all the casings and all the other explosive material and all the missiles that they put them on, all this. Just the core of the weapon. It costs $60 million to produce one of them, and they want to produce 30 per year within a few years and then ramp it up to 50. And one plutonium pit, at $60 million, you could pay 700 nurses' salaries with that. And the cost of the entire nuclear weapons modernization program is recently calculated at approximately, we spend about $60 to $70 billion per year. $60 to $70 billion, and this is the whole weapons complex across the United States, all the different components. That's only nuclear weapons. That's not the whole military. That's not the whole Pentagon. That's not the whole war machine. It's just the nuclear weapons program. $60 to $70 billion a year. We could end all homelessness in the United States for $20 billion. And we could end all hunger and feed every hungry adult and child in the United States for $25 billion. So we could house the homeless, feed all the hungry people, and still have plenty of money left over for
billions.
The amount that we're throwing. Yeah, we got $45 billion there. So, and that leaves another $20 billion or so to provide health care for people or whatever else you want to do. That's how much we're throwing into nuclear weapons when we already have 1,800 approximately nuclear weapons that are sitting on missiles and pointed at Moscow and Beijing and deployed, ready to fire. So we got thousands of them. We have enough to destroy all life on Earth and many other planets combined, and they want to build more just because they want to spend money. And defense contractors want to make money. And it has nothing to do with defense. It has nothing to do with our safety. And it has nothing to do with anything useful but except taking money away from basic needs that people have.
Sally.
The problem with reframing that I constantly come up against is the indoctrination of the people that America has the right, the God-given right to run the whole damn world.
Yes.
And because we're so much better than everybody else. It's just drilled in us from the time you're in kindergarten till you get through your PhD. We are superior. And we don't cooperate with other people because we don't have to. They should do what we want them to do. I don't know how you reframe that.
I've had personal experience recently with how broken the medical system is, the healthcare system, the education. If it gets to be so bad and people realize where's the money for this and they realize it's all going to picking fights with other people overseas, maybe that will reframe it. And we're going through unprecedented hard times in this country, and maybe it needs to get worse, but eventually we need to fix things up here. I mean, how else can it be? Thank you, everybody.
You were just listening to Kuhan Patmander, on arms race equals suicide race. She spoke at the Albuquerque Center for Peace and Justice on June 25th, 2023. Kuan Pakmander is a journalist, filmmaker, author, and peace and environmental activist. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Noam Chomsky, Medea Benjamin, Arundhati Roy, Uma Shakur, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Kuan Pakmander on Arms Race Equals Suicide Race, and for Norman Solomon's book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Bob Anderson and Stop the War Machine. Mike Swick recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.